Radio.
This talk was presented by Dr. Robert Tilley on the topic, The Sacrament of Reconciliation, Our Responsibility for Becoming Truly and Fully Human. This was recorded at the Eyewitness Conference 2012 in Stanmore Tobs, New South Wales.
Look, I'm actually going to be speaking about confession rather around the subject, not so much directly to the subject, and that for a number of reasons. Not least, I think a theological disquisition on confession is probably better given by one of the priests or bishops here. And in fact, in the Mass, I think the bishop's homily actually sort of touches a little bit on the approach I do want to take. And I think that'll become a bit clearer when I start proper. Whatever we mean by reconciliation and confession, I think what we primarily mean is actually revealing ourselves, is actually an unconcealing. One of the major problems all of us confront, both unconsciously and consciously, is a desire to remain hidden. And that's something the bishop brought out in a homily. One of the first things that happen with the fall, when their eyes are opened, is that they see that each other are naked. Now, this doesn't really have anything to do with matters sexual, because of course they've been told to go forth and multiply. But what happens is that they conceal their bodies from each other. And one of the reasons we conceal ourselves is because we feel vulnerable and suspicious. It's something along that line that I want to address. So the first thing I'd suggest is that when you look around you, when you look around you now, you might ask yourself, what is it that is present here near Wollongong in Sydney, in Australia, in the world? What is it that is present around you that's going to last forever? In a sense, what is it around you right now that is already in some sense living in eternity? And the answer, of course, is that that person next to you. Indeed, you. You are never going to pass away. And that actually is a really terrifying thought. Kierkegaard, the 19th century Danish Protestant philosopher, argued in his book Sickness Unto Death that the desire for annihilation is the wish fulfillment to be quit of ourselves. To live forever is a rather frightening prospect. You yourself are never going to pass away, and yet you and everyone else is going to change for better or for worse. Though we ourselves remain ourselves, in some way we can either become more truly ourselves or less ourselves. One of the interesting things that many religions have in common is this. Whether or not they hold to something like reincarnation and karma, or heaven and hell, or heaven and hell and purgatory, most religions hold that what we do here, what we do on this earth, what we do in this life, affects in some incredibly serious and important way what comes after. Every religion or every major religion basically holds that what it is we do here now affects in a very profound and serious way what it is that comes after. Why? Why is that? Why is this life, so much like a preparation for what comes later? There are many ways in which one could answer that question, but today I want it to suffice to merely say that in a way this life is like soil, is like the dirt, is like soil, hopefully good soil. What I mean by that is this life is like soil, and our lives, each of our lives, are like seeds that are sown in this soil. And the life, you could say, that comes after is like the seed that then grows into a plant that breaks through the soil and blooms, or, as case may be, one hopes not, eternally withers. This metaphor is, of course, a metaphor that St. Paul uses for resurrection from the dead in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, 20 to 58. And it's something that St. Paul took from other Christians, earlier Christians, and it's something that they clearly took from Jesus Christ himself. The theme of soil and seed, and whether or not it grows in abundance or becomes a weed. Whatever we make of this, it means that life here today is not trivial. In fact, life is very, very serious. And by that I don't mean that life is gloomy, anxious, or depressed. Quite the reverse. If the soul, and we're talking about the soul here, if the soul is what we're talking about, then we're talking about taking care for the soul. And if the soul is that which lasts forever, and the care and the concern for the soul is what is most important, then in point of fact, many of the cares and anxieties of this world, career, status, wealth, even health and comfort, all the cares of this world, all the anxieties of this world, in fact, begin to look trivial. They begin to look trivial. To think about your death is actually rather liberating because it puts things in perspective. To the degree that you take to heart the fact that it is you and your neighbor that will last forever, that everything else will pass away, then to that degree, you will be free of the anxieties attendant upon the world. You will begin to see that joy, that true joy, attends Jesus' words when he told his disciples to care not for the morrow, but first of all to seek the kingdom of God in Matthew chapter 6. But here I want to make, and we've got to be very careful to make a distinction, there's a world of difference between not having a care in the world and having every care for the world. There's a world of difference between not having a care in the world and in fact having every care for the world. Many of the saints had both. They didn't have a care in the world, they'd renounced everything, so what did it matter to them if they were poor or rich or anything like that? And yet at the same time, they had every care for the world. For the world is made up of souls that suffer and are in great danger and great pain, not least pain and danger that we cause ourselves, for often we are our most deadly enemies. We are the source of a good deal of our own unhappiness. For we might put it like this: sin does not hurt God. Sin does not hurt God, except insofar as it hurts him to see us hurting ourselves and others. Sin does not hurt God, except insofar as sin hurts God to see us hurting ourselves and others. There's a bit of a mystery in this. Who are we? What are we? That we can seek to destroy ourselves and that, and usually do it more often than not, exactly when we think we're making ourselves happy. We think that in seeking out all manner of trivial entertainment and fun distractions that we are being happy. And they have a place, of course, as any entertainment has a place. But to in fact define your life by that, we deep down know that it is only when we are serious that we are happy. It's only when we are serious that we are happy. All of us know that it is when we are serious that we experience a sense of meaning, of purpose, stability, of being grounded, of being focused and being centered, of having substance. And what's more, in and through this seriousness, we even feel an apprehension of beauty and joy. Entertainment's good, and sometimes just having simple fun is good and relaxing and is necessary. But to live your life, as I say, like that is to become without a center, without a substance, to be able to be knocked around any which way, to be one moment happy, another sad, another down, up, to be every which way. And that's not a happy life. Our culture, however, is one that is fundamentally opposed to seriousness. And our culture is opposed to seriousness because it is based upon and informed by consumer distractions and happy appearances. So it's very difficult for everyone, for all of us, to live in this kind of economy. It's very difficult to be serious when we live in the world that we do, in an economy that we do. And it's a point to which I'll return. All this raises a question then, what are some of the practical ways to remind ourselves of seriousness and thereby to free ourselves for at least a little time, and one might hope for increasing amounts of time? What are some of the practical ways that might save us from the inanity and vapidness, the superficiality and insubstantiality of our consumer culture? And one of the ways, I think, is that which the world attacks a church for. Not, I guess, more pertinently, recently, with the idea that the sacrament and the seal of the confession, well, the seal of the confession should be done away with, and priests ought to report child molesters. We all know that it wouldn't stop there. Why child molesters? Why not murderers? Why not thieves? Why not people who smoke in no smoking zones after a while? We know that would happen. You break the seal of the confession in one part, it'll be broken in all. I think one of the chief ways of being serious is confession. I'm a Catholic convert of, I guess, 15 years now. And I was a very ardent Protestant of the Calvinist variety. Very, very strong Calvinist. And I loathed the idea of confession. And I thought it was something of the Antichrist. I speak quite literally. When I was a Protestant in the 80s and the early 90s, the only form of confession that I thought necessary was to confess directly to God. The idea of confession to a priest was, to put it mildly for me, repugnant. But that didn't blind me to the problem of, let's call it, direct confession to God. That didn't blind me to the problem. You see, it very easily became something trivial. You did something and you go, oh, sorry, God. And that's a sure sign, too, of passive aggression. You'll often get people apologizing for something while they're still continuing to do it. In fact, they're apologizing as a means to keep on doing it. And when you have, and I'm not saying this for all people, because of course there are Protestants very much of good faith, but unfortunately, the discipline of direct confession would inevitably lead to a trivializing of your sin. I'm not saying that God does not hear such confessions or that he does not forgive. Clearly he can and does. The point, though, has to do with what is the best and most appropriate way of confession. Put it like this. The Second Vatican Council taught us, and in fact the Church taught us prior to the Second Vatican Council, that those who are outside the visible Church can be saved. Of course they can. As the Cardinal pointed out in his discussion with Dawkins, atheists of good faith and justice will find their way to heaven. And the reason for that is because they will ultimately, whether they know it or not, participate in the grace of Jesus that comes through the cross and that is found in the Church. The aim is for a visible unity in the Church, and consequently the same thing too. People through direct confession to God, I'm sure, will be answered by God. But the question is, what is the best way, the most perfect way, the proper way to be human? What is the more serious way, I would argue? When I was still a Protestant, this was I think in the late 80s, I was actually at a friend's family home. And one night we watched on video, because they had videos in those days, the film, The Mission. The film, The Mission. I've got to say, as a whole, the film didn't do much for me, I'm sorry. In fact, I found the major character really rather insipid, but be that as it were, maybe that says more about me. But there was one part of the film that did do something to me, despite my ardent Protestantism. The character played by Robert De Niro, a soldier by trade, kills his brother in a duel over a mistress that they now find they share. It was De Niro's mistress. His brother, as it were, semi-cuckolds him, as it were. Robert De Niro doesn't take kindly to this, and they have a duel, and De Niro kills his brother. De Niro's character experiences remorse, and prompted by this, goes and confesses his sin to the priest. A Protestant view of the matter would have been well and good. He is remorseful, he only has to ask God for forgiveness, and he will be forgiven. But to say it like that really makes it trivial. In the film, the De Niro character has to do his penance, and his penance consists in carrying his armor and his weaponry up to the top of a waterfall. He has to climb up this waterfall, laden down with his armor and his weaponry. And when he gets to the top, he has to cut the rope and let all his armor and weaponry fall to the bottom down into the water. It's an arduous climb, an arduous penance. But what impressed me, but really what moved me, was a sense of the seriousness of sin that that sense of confession and penance carried. Even as an ardent Protestant, that stayed with me. Though most of the other film didn't. But we might say that a trivial view of sin is expressed in what the Protestant martyr Dietrich Bonhoeffer called famously cheap grace. Cheap grace. But I think we can say something more. A trivial view of sin and a cheap view of grace both express a trivial and cheap view of ourselves and, for that matter, of others, which in turn expresses itself in a cheap view of reality, indeed of being itself, the very beingness of being itself. We start, I think, to see ourselves and others as something insubstantial, unstable. We experience things as ultimately unhappy. To be happy, you must be very serious. Look, if you build your house on vapid, in a vapid and superficial way, in a trivial way, using what is cheap and easy at hand, you might be happy for a short time with the labor that you've saved and the cost you've saved, but you're not going to be happy living in that house. There's going to be all manner of problems. What I want to bring out here is the way in which we treat of sin and confession, the way in which that reflects upon the way in which we treat of being human. There's something, there is something about serious confession that accords with being truly human, and this is what I want to try to tease out. Both from my personal experience, and I would argue the lesson of history, one can say that easy confession, direct to God, easily breeds presumptuousness, in that one can sin, and all the while thinking that after it is done, I can just say sorry to God, just like that. But there's something about confessing to a priest that, to a degree at least, checks this. I think that it does more so than doing it when you think you do it direct to God. And I think one of the reasons is that when you're with a priest, you're in the presence of another human being, one who knows the like tricks and excuses we all use. And I guess after a priest has been doing confession for quite some time and taken, they've probably heard it all. In short, we can feel a little embarrassed at times going to confession. Something, yes, that we ought to feel before God, but in actual practice do not. Well, at least most of us do not do. It's easy to think that we can hide from God, that we can hide God away from ourselves through a kind of manufactured sense of familiarity, while with another person before us, someone who is in our sensory orbit, someone who's in our sensory presence, there is an inescapable sense of another to our fallen senses. There is another person there. Someone who is not merely a construct of our imagination, so often that we have constructed God in our imagination. The sacramental nature of confession to one side, there is in confession an objectivity that cuts through the cozy comfort of our self-pleasing image of our sin. So many times, I guess, when one goes to confession, you often feel a little bit like you wish you had murdered someone, so at least it sounds like some sort of very adult sin, whereas most of our sins are, of course, of the trivial, petty, habitual kind that shame and embarrass us so often. But that's the point, really. That's where we need to be serious, because it's the trivial things like that that really show us if we're serious. Confession makes us that little bit more serious about sin and our sense, therefore, of the soul, of our soul and the soul of our neighbours. And I think it does it for this reason. It helps us to be serious because it helps us to be responsible. I mean by that, that we are made to feel that little bit more responsible about what it is we have done or failed to do. And for this reason, it's for this reason that confession, in helping us to be serious, does actually help us to become mature. It helps us thereby to become fully human. Maturity is actually to grow serious. Because in maturity, we grow in the apprehension of our responsibility, both for our own soul and for the soul of others. We grow in the sense of the duties of our being part of humanity and part of the world. We grow in the apprehension of our duties and responsibilities as citizens, both of this world and the world to come. We all ought to mature such that we do not have a care in the world, but instead have every care for the world. To return to what I touched upon a little bit earlier, the problem, and all of us confront this, maybe you more so because you have been really, really drenched in this culture and brought up in this culture. The problem that all of us confront is a problem that might be said to be unique in the history of the world. I'm sure there might be one or two small examples that say otherwise, but I do think on a general level, what we all live in is unique in the history of the world. And it's this: our increasing global culture is one that has an investment in you staying immature. The increasing global marketplace has an investment in you staying immature. You see, immaturity is beneficial for a consumer and market economy. Of course it is. If we are cashed up children, then we will always be wanting to indulge our every desire, and we'll be able to do so, buying whatever it is we need that will meet the demands of the moment. And this will result in a very prosperous market for toys for people of all ages, such that in advertisements, there's no embarrassment about selling them as toys for boys who might be in their 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s or 90s. To be immature is to live in the moment, is to live as being led by your every whim and want. It is to want something and to want it now, to demand it now. It is for this reason that our culture patronizes you. It patronizes you. It thinks to make no great demands intellectually, artistically, or religiously on you, because they want you to be little kids. You make demands of adults. It doesn't want to make the message too serious because it might upset you. It might make you scared and fearful. It might make you even feel stupid. It might even give you low self-esteem and perish the thought. In short, our culture cannot be described as a serious culture. And yet, the things that we do, I'm not just talking about abortion and the whole theme of culture of death, but the whole armaments we manufacture, the ability of them to be able to do horrendous things, the very fact that we have torture, be it in Guantanamo Bay or here, the very fact that we can have maximum security prisons like at Goulburn, where we can lock away someone in a plastic queue for 23 hours a day and drive them mad. That's our culture. And yeah, we're not meant to be serious. Our culture is not a serious culture, except when it is serious about having fun. But in fact, all children really are serious about having fun. So serious, in fact, that if they are not having fun and not being indulged, then they get very upset and sad and cry and scream until they are pacified. And of course, for little children, that's appropriate, though very vexing. Immaturity is characterized by being at the prey of your feelings. One moment you're up, then you're down, you feel empty, you feel elated. And they want you more and more to feel like this. And the point is that when you feel this gamut of feelings down and up and all that, you actually tend to think that at the end of the day that you have lived. That that's what it is to live, to have a whole range of experiences. In actual fact, you have not lived. You have consumed experiences. And yes, that's tourism, of course, but it's the everyday life as well. You have consumed experiences and products that have been crafted with the market in mind. You have not lived, for you have not grown in maturity and seriousness. For life is growth in maturity. And maturity is to grow in the exercise of reason and moral responsibility. And you can't buy reason and moral responsibility on the marketplace. They have to do with you as a human being, and thus they require personal effort. I want to stress a point the church has taught since its very beginnings. And the reason why the church has taught this since its very beginnings is for the simple reason that it is part of the patrimony, part of the inheritance of all humanity. It's been around since the very beginning of humanity among those the wisest in humanity. And what they have taught since the beginning of history is that to become truly human, we must learn to subordinate our feelings and passions, our wants, to reason and moral responsibility. That is not to become an unfeeling robot. Of course it isn't. What it is to actually deepen your feelings and passions by disciplining them. You rein them in and you deepen them. If you give in to your feelings and passions, of course, we all know what happens. They die. They die an easy death. And you'll try and revive them, but you may as well forget it because it's never going to be the same, to pardon the term, as the first time. That's the nature of the feelings and passions. But you discipline them, you rein them in, then you can deepen them and make them last. To be human is to grow in maturity, and to grow in maturity is to grow in the use of reason and moral responsibility. To grow in the true exercise of your will, which brings us back to the subject of confession. And why it is that confession is one of the preeminent ways, I'd say, of growing in maturity that is available to those of us in the church. What Christianity tells us is this, is that the exercise of a true and good will is impossible without the grace of God. It's impossible without the grace of God. There is natural grace that applies to all people, and of course the supernatural grace that comes to us through the sacraments. But here's the thing about the grace of God. What the church teaches us is this. The grace of God is not, as many seem to think, an excuse for passivity. Grace does not make you passive. Quite the reverse. What do you think grace does? It revives you. It makes your spirit alive. It gives you life. And being living means you will. God's grace is not a cause of immaturity, of passivity. Rather, does God's grace work to free our will such that we will grow in our conscious cooperation with the grace of God. And that means doing things when we don't feel like doing them, but we know they're right. And one of the principal means by which we learn to consciously cooperate with God and receive this grace is, of course, confession. Confession is a principal means to our maturity. Confession answers to our human nature. And I would argue for this reason, get a bit political here, that those priests who actually play down confession, or those laity and priests who only want the third rite is when everyone in the congregation and there's a group absolution. But of course with the third rite, you're meant to at the first opportunity to go to confession proper. But I would argue those priests and laity who downplay confession or want only the third rite, implicitly so, are patronizing you. They're patronizing the laity. By wishing to keep us, that is the laity, to the level of little children. One way to illustrate what I'm arguing for here is by noting a universal experience in any serious religious walk. At the beginning of any conversion, we are full of zeal and energy. We feel we could this very day renounce the world and preach Jesus and even be martyred. And that's a right feeling for the beginning. We often think that life is short and things are urgent, but in point of fact, it's quite the other way. Life, for most of us, is long. Often it is too long, for soon enough we tire of the pains and irritations and setbacks of life and we set back down into a kind of easy or uneasy comfort. We soon lose the urgency that so invigorated us and we begin to experience our faith as something dead, meaning by this that it no longer fills us full of joy and eager expectation. Well, that's because you're no longer a child. You're no longer a child. You're meant to actually apply your will. This is a well-known phenomena and it serves the consumer market really well. It's a well-known phenomena in spiritual and New Age and self-help publishing. Believe me, they consciously understand this. The idea that people find one guru, read one book, adopt one diet, learn one new technique, feel over the moon and then think that they have found the answer to all unhappiness and ill health. They've found it. Only a few months later, what happens is they're again looking for the next hit. They find a new book, a new guru, a new technique, a new diet. And again, they're over the moon and they think they've found it and they're going to be eternally happy. And then a few months later, it goes again. Publishers of New Age book know that those who buy their bestseller books are basically the same market over and over and over again. But we all can tend to fall into that trap. Religious life tends to be one that, yes, begins with a kind of almost childish and good zeal, but soon begins to demand of us that we cooperate with grace of God. In other words, yes, in our early time of religious life and at certain times in our religious life, we can be totally consumed by the grace of God and have an ecstatic experience. But of course, that's few and far between, and that is not the normal course. We're instead called to bend our will, to struggle with ourselves, to cooperate with grace, not to be immersed and totally taken away, but to cooperate. Religious life is like that because life is like this. As children, we are given largesse and are carried around and indulged. We can think ourselves awfully smart and wonderful when we're young, and some too when we're old. Only when we go to school or somewhere, we get a rude awakening. We learn that there is in life friction and frustration. And we learn, or we ought to learn, that we need to be humble. Grace works at first on us as our, or we hope, our parents worked on us when we were children. They carried us around, as it were. But if our parents kept us as little children, we would think them wicked and depraved. For they ought to train us to become like they are, mature adults who can walk on their own two feet. Contrary to what cute and kitsch religion teaches us, we are called to walk with God as friends, and even mystically so as lovers, not always to be carried around as children. Confession works to bring us to be mature enough to know our sins, to have us unconcealed, to get into the habit of unconcealing ourselves to another, and to seek not only forgiveness, but the strength of grace to try again and again and again and again and again and so on and so forth, to grow. We need, and I want to stress this to make something else clear, maturity is not, in fact, to think that you stand unaided on your own two feet. I think that's a problem that I confronted in Protestantism. You forget the necessity of the church that Jesus founded. You think that you can stand on your own two feet before God, but in point of fact, you can do no such thing. Whether you're in the visible church or not, whether you're an atheist or another religion, ultimately, you stand before God in grace or otherwise by reason of Jesus Christ and his body, the church. It's something I think our capitalist consumer economy tries to inculcate, the idea of you stand on your own two feet, and thus, because I'm a rich mining magnate, I deserve the billions of dollars that I have, and people should be paid the same kind of wages they get paid in Africa. And you should have less holidays as well. Because I did it, I have billions of dollars, why can't you? That's a sound of a child speaking that, of someone immature. Something else that confession teaches us is this. Maturity tells us just how much we owe to others and, of course, to God. How dependent we are on others. But here's the point. How dependent they are on us. How all of us, to some degree, are responsible for others. And our growth and maturity teaches us about moral responsibility, taking others into account, and learning to take our political as well as religious duties seriously. If you don't vote, and if you don't think about whom you're voting for, you are like children. All of us ought to make it our goal to become strong and mature enough to be a dependable source of strength for others, and to become wise and humble enough to know that we need others in order to become strong and mature enough to be a source of strength for us, ourselves and others. And finally, in the Bible, we read about rewards in heaven. As a Protestant, this was a great problem, the idea that there are rewards in heaven. But that's actually all through the Bible, and especially the New Testament. And these rewards in heaven are often referred to as crowns. As crowns that will be received when Jesus returns. So in light of what I've been discussing, I think it's really pertinent to see what these crowns in fact are. In 1 Thessalonians chapter 2, verses 19 to 20, St. Paul writes this. For what is our hope or joy or crown of boasting before our Lord Jesus at his coming? Is it not you? For you are our glory and joy. What is our hope or joy or crown of boasting before our Lord Jesus at his coming? It is you, for you are our glory and joy. When Jesus speaks of laying up treasures in heaven that do not rust or decay, but rather last forever, we can see from St. Paul why it is these treasures in heaven last forever. Because they are other people. They are the souls of people. They are other people. They are the eternal souls you see around you today. And one hopes that treasure includes you all. But it's something to bear in mind through it all. In order to gain that strength, of course, the Mass is absolutely essential, but so too confession. And in gaining that strength and maturity, you gain the ability to be a source of strength and stability to others, not just in the church, but in a society at large as well. And not just on earth, but also in heaven. So I'll finish there.
For more talks recorded at Eyewitness 2012, visit cradio.org.au or xt3.com. To find out more about the Eyewitness Conference, visit lifetothefull.com.au. Cradio, nourishing the soul of the digital generation.